Hello and welcome everyone back to the Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop, and joined alongside me today is a familiar face to longtime listeners, but for maybe some of our new listeners, let me introduce you to Anthony Moore. Anthony, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Great to be back.
Yeah, and it's the first time that we've had a chance to do the show together. And obviously we kind of prefaced last week, Whitney Wright. She's actually in the process of moving right now, but I think we'll probably get a chance to work on a lot of these things a little bit more together. And it's a lot of fun digging into the news. You and I get to talk shop all the time off air. And so now our audience will get to join in on some of our, what I think are really fun conversations about industry stuff on the air in front of everyone.
Well, if I want to hear from anyone, it's you about this stuff. So everyone is in for a treat. So let's do it.
All right. What do we have on the docket today?
So we're talking about a few things today. First of all, we're going to cover Google's EEAT, experience, expertise, authoritativeness, and trustworthiness, and what Google's kind of said about that and how it affects SEO, what that really means, because Google has notoriously said this isn't a factor we consider, but it really is if you think about it. Next, we're going to talk about Google bolstering advertising on YouTube Shorts. There's a lot of activity going on YouTube Shorts. It's a TikTok competitor in a sense, and I think just from last year alone, it's gone up from about 30 billion views a month to about 50 billion views a month. Big explosion there. So Google is really trying to input a lot of better advertising for creators and advertisers alike. And lastly, there is a lot going on this week, as in every week, with AI. Tomorrow, from the recording, there's a lot of really major AI CEOs and decision makers who are heading to the White House to talk to Kamala Harris and a lot of chief executives of the White House to talk about essentially safety in AI and regulating what is a very fast and active dynamic happening right now with AI.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be a real technical conversation. We're going to get into the weeds of AI.
So what is AI again?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm noticing, you know, from the first story, the extra E. So is this a new thing that people have been using? This EEAT, or is that the news in of itself? I'm familiar with EAT, EAT, but now I'm seeing everywhere people adding this additional E to the beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been a publisher for a long time, 10, 12 years, and I was following SEO very closely. Getting views is very important to me. And it does seem like Google has always used these buzzwords. And what is really the concrete difference between expertise and experience and authoritativeness? And what does it all mean? So I, like everyone else, I'm not quite sure what Google's trying to do here, but there are these important traits in their mind that publishers should be following. So it's kind of a mixed bag when you're trying to figure out what is Google even talking about.
Yeah, and I feel like Google almost leans into the fact that I think a lot of things in SEO, and our audience can probably relate to this, is you sort of feel like you're like a detective on the case of a serial killer that leaves clues behind time, you know, where it's like they add a word to their, you know, their Raider guidelines or something. And then you start asking yourself like, well, it's probably just them updating it. But then you're like, but is it a clue?
Yeah, you know, to what it means.
And, you know, in my experience, when Google changes stuff, or adds things or updates something, there's usually a purpose. Now, is that purpose significant? Is it, you know, meaningful? Are they trying to tell people something? A lot of times, and I would say probably most of the time, no. It's probably many cases like an internal boring process that they're dealing with. But the experience part does ring true to me from the standpoint of if you really think about it, one of the things that I've seen come up a lot is it specifically relates to GPT. I noticed that with the Hollywood writer's strike that just started the other day, one of their key sort of messages that I've seen on the signs and in articles is they call them plagiarism machines. Mm. And I listened to a data scientist the other day say that, you know, ChatGPT, it's the ultimate plagiarism machine or regurgitator. Mm. And, you know, there is this, you know, amazing innovation that we have now, but it does rely on human source material pretty much exclusively.
Yeah.
And I find that, you know, when I used to talk about like topics that AI is going to struggle with, you know, I always would, you know, give the you know, crying baby example, something that you probably can relate to right now.
Actual crying babies in the home.
Yeah. Is a new father that's got a child at home. It's like, you know, if you were to try to ask, you know, do you want ChatGPT's answer on how to stop a crying baby? Or do you want maybe your mom or dad's or friends, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's where that experience part maybe is coming into, where it's like, if Google can find a way that it can reliably say, like, look, this is content that's based on experience, and this is a query, or this is something that people are looking for that, you know, relies on human experience, like, maybe that's something that we want to try to prioritize.
Yeah, well, I think with this advent of ChatGPT, and it's just so good at giving every answer, right? But if you look at it, not every answer is that helpful. And I've been, I mean, like everyone here probably has been messing with it. I've been asking all kinds of just amusing questions. Like, how do I get over a breakup? Like, how do I, you know, like it's like stuff that an AI wouldn't know, and it gives its best answer, but it's not always that helpful. It's like, forget it. This isn't worth it. I'm going to go to someone with actual experience, like, you know, like in like helping a crying baby, my mom, or a breakup experience, whatever, some relationship coach. So this stuff that Google is trying to find, I think publishers have an opportunity to be better than GPT and be better than AI content by actually having actual experience.
Yeah.
And not plagiarizing stuff. And like, I've used a ChatGPT to like write articles as if I was Stephen King, you know, or as if I was Ernest Hemingway, and seeing how it comes out. And like, you can kind of see, it's like, oh yeah, it sounds a bit like that. That's like what I would imagine.
Yeah.
But it can't create you and your exact voice and your exact experiences. It has like, I've like just asked funny questions, like stuff that it would never know. Like, who's your best friend? Or like, where were you born? Like, how did that like affect you? It's funny seeing the answers, but that's the stuff the publishers can do and rely on that AI can never do, as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm reluctant to use this example. Our audience knows that I often give examples that are strange and bizarre. This one's actually quite apt, but the reason why I bring it up is maybe not the best one, is because I do think that it's a paradigm shift that we'll see major movement on in general over the next 10 years, and that is medicine. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, you know, why would you even go to a doctor when, you know, most of the reliable information that you can find on modern medicine is actually on the internet. In fact, I would say that probably you can find material there that your doctor probably is not privy to or aware of. Mm-hmm. However, if you have a problem, you probably go to a doctor because you need that sort of like that wisdom, that discernment. You need somebody that sort of can parse through the information for you, because, you know, unless you've gone to medical school and studied medicine, it would be easy to read something and be like, oh, well, this is clearly what's wrong with me. But you may have a doctor say, well, you know, I've seen this before, or I've practiced medicine for 30 years, and this is sort of my assessment, which may be different. And I think that that is one of the things that humans add to modern publishing, that, you know, quite frankly, if you look at a lot of the content that's out there, it was regurgitated already by humans, and now there's a machine that can do it. And I think it allows, like I think you put really well, is that it allows people to be better, make better content, and it really allows the cream to rise to the top, as opposed to, you know, you've got somebody that's basically rewriting something that's already been written, and they're adding some more images or maybe a little bit of context or something like that.
Yeah. I think there's a very black and white approach you can take to content and, you know, using SEO and trying to rank specifically just to rank. And what you do when you're trying to enter that arena is you're fighting against ChatGPT and AI, where it's almost like you're fighting against a dictionary, you're fighting against encyclopedia. There's no way you're going to out-knowledge that thing. But what you can do is use your own experience, your own expertise, your own authenticity in ways that GPT just can't do. So I think publishers are in a cool place where they can be challenged to be better than an encyclopedia. It's like, you can't beat it in the knowledge, but you can beat it in connecting with your audience and sharing stories only you know, in ways that, you know, you can work on your own writing skills. And so if you're just going to settle for this basic content, I think that GPT will win over time. But I don't think that GPT will ever really reach people who are really good at sharing their experiences and expertise in ways that machine just can't replicate.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point. And that's, you know, like, if you think about your audience as sort of your customer base, your content is a product, but rarely is your audience, are they coming to you and saying, hey, I want product, right? Like, I want content from you. Usually they've found you, or they've maybe they do follow you for one reason or another. You're an influencer and you have a website or something. But the reality is that you're providing expertise, authority, you know, like you're an authority on something, you're trustworthy. Like, these are truly the things that your customers are coming to you for. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good reminder, I think, just to remember, like, what am I producing for who, and like, why is it that they want that from me? Yeah. And I think it, you know, lends itself really well to, you know, this is why we've seen creators sort of like rise, which I think kind of lends itself to, you know, the next story that you kind of brought up, which is the, you know, the YouTube shorts.
Yeah, man, I want this. This could be like a 2-hour podcast. It's not going to be that, man. This is so fascinating. One last thing I'll say about that last point is I saw a Black Mirror episode, and it was like, why did I just know it was like this weird futuristic tech, you know, nightmares. And essentially there was this company that remade like deceased loved ones. And this like wife had like, you know, like her like husband passed away, and she like ordered like a new one. And it just wasn't quite the same. It was almost there, but it's like, she wanted to fight with him, like wanted to like have like passionate arguments, and he just couldn't do that. And I think in like a way GPT is kind of like that, where it's like, it's not quite like that oomph that people come to a real publisher for. Anyway, yep. Again, 2-hour talk on that. We won't do that. Let's move on to YouTube Shorts.
That episode is one that I think of very often. Yeah. Actually, now in the position that we're in, there's so much source material of me in particular online, from television broadcasts in sports, which I did for a really long time, all the way to all the different types of podcasts and stuff like that I've been on. And then obviously this one, where it's like, I'm a very easy thing to clone.
Oh, yeah.
From a media perspective. And so, yeah, like we've been working on a bunch of different ways of doing that. And I'm always testing it against my wife. She's like the the litmus test for
it. Is it really me?
How real is it?
Oh, yeah. Fascinating stuff. Honestly, I want to keep talking about that. Maybe we'll do it in future episodes. Let's talk really quickly about Google and YouTube Shorts. So at the time of this recording, there's a lot going on in TikTok right now, which is obviously like the biggest kind of like short form video content platform. It might be banned in America. Who knows? There's legislation going against that for privacy issues. But essentially, YouTube Shorts is trying to recreate a similar platform. And there's a lot of activity and a lot of potential for advertisers and content creators alike about this. According to a Google-sponsored program, Talk Shop, they said viewers now report watching more short form video, and I think that's 60 seconds or less, short form video than studio produced TV and films. So there's a lot of activity all the time. I mean, me, my wife, all our friends, we watch it all the time as well. There's a lot of eyeballs on YouTube Shorts. And Google is trying to make it easier for advertisers to put their ads on there by introducing first position on Shorts, where essentially an ad shows up as soon as you first click on your scrolling session. So there's a lot of activity there, and I'm curious what you think about how advertisers and content creators can approach that, and maybe some best practices knowing this current boom of activity on the platform.
Well, I think it's a really great opportunity for people that especially are already maybe on YouTube, because it gives you a chance to explore something that, you know, I remember from a topic from a podcast maybe a couple episodes ago, where we were talking about just the rise of TikTok, both as a search engine. It's like, I think, like 30% of like all searches now go to TikTok or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe that was Gen Z. I'd have to go back and look, but
yeah.
It was, you know, the amount of ad business that they have churned up over the last couple of years is pretty significant. So that's obviously what Google's doing here, is they're trying to make sure, and they've had this kind of like in the works for a couple of years now. I remember when they first released it, I was like, oh, this is great. It kind of feedifies YouTube and makes it a little bit more mobile friendly.
Yeah.
But this is obviously a TikTok sort of like, you know, competitor. But I think a lot of YouTubers have probably struggled to figure out like, how do I grow an audience on TikTok, or how do I get onto this platform, because it's a lot different. This gives you a chance to kind of like work that out, I think, because you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, I did a presentation at Google for one of our events. And one of the things that I had up on the screen was this, I was kind of making fun of Samsung, who was trying to make a TV that was a vertical TV. So it was like, you know, aspect ratio of like a cell phone.
Yeah,
and I was like, this is a great example of someone not kind of understanding and getting the trends, because they were showing the rise of short form mobile video, and that it would overtake regular sort of like television viewing, or, or even YouTube videos by, I think they had predicted like 2022 or something. Oh. And one of the audience members said, you know, I know that that's what the, you know, the stats say or the, you know, analysis shows, but I just don't believe it. I don't believe that people will watch short form videos on their phone more minutes a day than, you know, people do regular video. And I was like, you know, it'll be interesting to see because it definitely seems like it's headed that direction. And now here we are. And it kind of seems funny to say that, you know, you wouldn't believe that this would be the case. But as a publisher, I look at this and I say, like, this is actually makes, if I'm not heavy into video, or maybe I am, this is like a training ground if I'm already in video for how do I grow an audience that's, you know, really, this is a segment that's going to grow. And then if I'm not in video a lot, I'm like, great. You know, I don't have to produce something that's like 2 hours long with a producer. It's like, I can try a lot of things out here and, you know, you don't, there's no penalty for failure.
Yeah. I think YouTube Shorts is also great for content creators who are not that experienced in video content creation, just to whip their phone out, record a quick video and upload it. And you're not going to maybe get millions of views really quickly, but it's a much lower barrier of entry than like actually sitting down the whole setup here with your camera and lighting. Like that's what I did. Like, you know, years ago, I like made like my first online course and I like borrowed them my like friend's $2,000 camera and his tripod. And I had like two lighting things and like a big backdrop and it was my small apartment. And it took like an hour and a half to set up. And I had to close all the windows because it was loud. I was like wearing a suit and I was sweating through my suit. And I would record like 20 minutes of content before I'd like tear it all down again. And it's like, now it's just like, you whip up your phone, press record for a minute or two. You have a YouTube short that you could put up there. So it's an opportunity for creators to skip this whole studio-like setup, pull up their smartphone, and start recording.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you carry around with you a camera at all times. It's as good as pretty much any camera that, like, existed before 2010.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you know, something I've brought up before, I don't know that if I've talked about it on the podcast, but if you look at basically just video content in general, since the advent of video, so let's just say 1900 to make a nice clean date, from 1900 until probably about 2009, right around the time of the smartphone, the quality of content has a linear direct correlation to basically like the audience. So like you think about like major motion pictures, blockbuster movies, the most people watch it, it's the highest quality production, right?
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden quality and basically like the reach or the popularity or the consumption of video, like those things became disconnected because now the expectation of quality is not something that you have to have as a prerequisite for generating a lot of, you know, views or an audience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you think about even some of the things that you watch, like viral videos and stuff like that, you know, sometimes you're like, what is that even shot on? It's like the lowest quality.
It's like shaking it around, you know?
Yeah. And so I think, you know, that again, it lends itself to like trying things. There's no penalty for making an effort. And I think this is a worthy effort if you're a publisher and you're not doing a lot in video. You know, 60 seconds isn't very long. And my guess is that whatever your industry is, your category is, your niche is, there's an opportunity there to try things with your audience.
Yeah, I was making some forays into social media stuff myself, and I had never done video on social media. You know, I was a publisher, I have my website, my writing, I was a writer, you know. But then I was like, there was so much opportunity for video content creation, so I was doing that more. And I would just pull my phone out on like walking my dog, you know, and like I would listen to like this like podcast. It was like it was just like this like guy talking on marketing on his commute to work. He just like put his phone on like the thing, you know, it's like so simple and so convenient. And I would upload it and I would get a decent number of views, like not millions, but I would have a presence online. People would comment, people would tune in to like live even. There's no editing. I'm just like pulling my phone out and then they're uploading it. It's a very low barrier of entry. Also, what YouTube has done is since a lot of people are used to like the whole horizontal size here of like the camera and using more traditional cameras, YouTube's campaign setup tools, they include AI-powered features to turn that horizontal video into more long-form vertical stuff. So it's so easy with whatever you want to do to make these YouTube short-type, short-form videos.
You're actually, in many cases with this, like almost penalized for investing a lot of time and energy into production because, like you said, like, you know, somebody just talks about something, you end up liking it, and like they realize like, oh, hey, I've got something here. you're better off like kind of throwing a lot of stuff out there that's maybe not the most polished to find what people really like, versus like you invest a lot of time and energy in something, no matter what, it's like these short kind of like skip through it videos, you know, even if you have a hit on your hands, it's like, are you going to get the ROI back from all the production you put into it? You know, it almost sort of penalizes those that are, you know, kind of like really sharpening things up and moving things around. It really lends itself to the sort of like, I'm just tossing stuff out there. Like, let's see what works. So,
yeah. I mean, one last one on that too, is like, you know, when I was first starting out publishing my old blog, I'm so glad I deleted it. It was horrible. I was writing about so many things. There was like 15 different topics. I would have like a movie review post and like a local restaurant review and then like some self-improvement stuff and then finances. I'd run everything, right? And like no one ever read anything because it was just all awful. But eventually what I did was like, I could use the numbers here as kind of like clues to see what works and what doesn't work. And it's like, oh, for some reason, my self-improvement articles always have double the views, which is like, you know, 30 instead of 15. Wasn't like a lot of views, but it was like, oh, there's actually more activity here. Maybe I can follow that. And, you know, lo and behold, that's what I was going to do eventually. And I'll get millions of views for that topic. And you can do the same thing with videos, where instead of spending, you know, like all day making a 2-minute video, like that's kind of polished and in like a studio, you can just be making a lot of content that is supposed to be churned through, because YouTube Shorts saying there's like billions and billions of views, to see which ones work. And you can use that data to make more informed decisions about your content, where it's like, that one had 20 views, this one had 50 views. Maybe I'm onto something here. And you can find that out in one day instead of like 2 weeks. So how much faster can you kind of get your answers?
Yeah. And if you're trying something new and you're not getting like, you just don't have access to the reach or the views to really know, am I onto something or not? You know, kind of looks like maybe more people watch this than that. You know, engagement, especially on certain topics, like you'll know when you have a hit, because you'll just immediately see like, wow, like people are actually like responding to or like sharing something, regardless of the views. Like that's always a good true north, I think, as well. It's like when you're onto something, it's like you get a lot of different types of signals, I feel like.
Yeah, I agree.
Hi, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Lyndon.
And we're here to tell you about a very exciting promotion happening in the month of May called Ezoic Empowers.
We're going to be giving away 8 5,000 word content packages to Ezoic publishers.
All you need to do to enter is post online using the hashtag Ezoic Empowers and share something that you're proud of accomplishing.
You can share literally anything. If you have a big data analytics report that's trending in the right direction, share that. If you have a Core Web Vitals score that you are proud of, please share that. Your Ezoic earnings report, anything of the sort. We want to see what you have to share and what you're proud of and celebrate you.
This promotion is running throughout the entire month of May from the 1st to the 31st, and we're going to be announcing winners by June 10th. You can enter multiple times.
For more information, you can head to ezoic.com/ezoic-empowers.
Woo!
Well, last topic here. Let's talk about this meeting tomorrow at the White House. A lot of AI CEOs, and including people from Google, Microsoft, ChatGPT, Anthropic, they're going to meet with White House officials about some regulations and privacy policies and just how we as a society can and should regulate this overwhelming tidal wave of AI. So do you have any thoughts on this meeting and kind of what that maybe signals for the larger landscape of society and AI?
You know, we talked before in the podcast a little bit about sort of the statement that I made before, is that, you know, AI is going to have different laws and rules than humans. We're not at this point yet where AI is this, you know, autonomous thing, or this kind of like this separate sort of entity that we're kind of like coexisting with yet. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily just a plagiarism machine in of itself yet, but I think we're in this nice happy medium ground right now where I think I mentioned in the last podcast, because it's a one clip that I saw online, and I like watched it and I was like, yeah, I still agree with myself on that one. So
yes,
take it as the most narcissistic thing you've heard all day. But I've kind of expanded on this a little bit, and it's that AI can probably be governed now largely by treating it almost like a minor, like an 11-year-old. Mm. So like, you know, who's responsible for, you know, an 11-year-old if they walk into a store and they steal something, right? It's like, well, they're with a parent, they're a minor. So how are we going to handle that in most cases? Well, the store, if they see it happen, you know, most likely they're going to be like, hey, stop doing that. Like, kid, give it back. If the parent's like, no, I'm going to let them just keep taking things, well, then you might have to call the authorities and say, like, look, this is an egregious example of somebody stealing something from me. You know, the courts, they're probably going to, I'm not going to get into the judicial advent of like, you don't want me to tell you guys how that would be handled. But realistically, it's like you're going to have a form of accountability where it's like in most cases you have a parent or guardian, whoever's like actively using the artificial intelligence that probably needs to be held accountable for anything that violates a current or existing law. And then if you have something that's like fundamentally bad, like I hate to use the example of like a kid that's like evil, but like if you have something to where it's like, look, there's nothing the parent or guardian can do. You know, this is the type of criminal action that something has to be held accountable for. If it's not the parent or guardian, the user, then it's most likely the creator. So it's, you've got the open AIs, the Microsofts of the world, the Alphabets. You know, if they built an AI that is like fundamentally breaking laws just by its very nature, then I think you have to hold them accountable. And that sort of like, I think, line will work for the foreseeable future. It won't work for forever. But I do think that probably the greatest thing that we have to look at in terms of the laws that it's violating are, you know, copyright and, you know, what source material are they using when they're producing something that's quote unquote new.
Yeah. It's hard to know if an AI has helped write something, who's the actual author here. I mean, even right now there is, at the time of this recording, there's a lot of very prominent AI speakers and people in the industry who are calling for a 6-month pause on AI development, just so that society can kind of get our ducks in a row and make some laws and regulation right now, including people like Elon Musk, Max Tegmark, a lot of AI, like prominent AI you know, researchers. And what's happening is AI is moving so fast because everyone sees the potential. And there's this kind of like double-sided coin of both fear and in some ways greed of like people like afraid of what's going to happen. And so they're like, you know, like shoring up their, you know, protection and making sure they're going to be protected any way they can. But there's also this opportunity to like, you know, reach it first and be like the market share and like capturing the most eyeballs as possible. So everyone is just rocketing as fast as they can across the board because they're afraid their competitor will or they're going to miss out. Meanwhile, there is a lot of like AI is just moving way faster than society is prepared for at this moment. So I think it's interesting that this is being talked at the highest levels of government, of authority on what to do about that, because there is so much potential of what we don't know can happen. And we're just falling behind on where this is going, and we could maybe crash if we're going too fast. You know?
And if this, there's no, to me, you're exactly right. And I think that this is, you know, this meeting is great evidence that if you think that this is some kind of like passing trend, or maybe it's not going to be that disruptive, this should tell you everything, because, you know, you politics, the government, you know, it doesn't matter what country you're in, especially with giant companies, you've got these giant bureaucracies on both ends. So usually it's like, oh, you want to have a meeting to discuss AI. Great. We're looking pretty good for October 2025, you know. But the fact that something like this is just is urgently sort of like planned, put together, it shows you that, you know, these parties, which are some of the largest in the world, that have to keep in mind a lot of competing interests and different things like that, they have concerns about how things are basically implemented and like what guardrails. And realistically, I don't think that we're going to be able to regulate or necessarily like control sort of the development and rollout of these things. But what we can do is we can build safeguards for ourselves. The thing that I've talked about previously is, you know, one of the more pressing and immediate threats that I think we all are going to have is security. So personal data security, you know, my voice is very easily cloned at the moment, as we mentioned earlier. So what's to stop me or someone posing as me is calling my wife and saying, hey, what's my social security number really quick? Or what's your social security number really quick? I'm at the bank or something, you know. It would be very easy. And so, you know, that's kind of traditionally been how hackers have gotten in anyways. It's like they've been able to fool somebody into thinking that there's someone else, as opposed to like, you know, the hard, you know, DDoS type attacks or something like that, cracking into the system. But now you've made that human sort of like security layer like basically worthless, because now you can duplicate other human behavior And if you can do that, then you can't rely on humans at any level to provide, you know, like this last layer of security. So I think it's things like that that we can probably think through the problem and solve. But the reality is the 6-month pause and stuff like that, as you mentioned, I think, you know, it just takes one person to decide that we're not going to do something. Yeah. And then it's like you've got this, you know, runaway and the innovation and, you know, no one wants to be left behind.
Yeah. Our kid was born late December. And so I took out a few weeks for paternity leave and stuff, you know, and ChatGPT launched in January, I think, or it was like, that's when like it really blew up, like 50 million users in like 1 month, right? And I came back to work and I was like, oh, what's this ChatGPT? I was just busy being awake every day and all night crying baby. And so I came back and there's a lot going on with ChatGPT, which I hadn't heard about really. And then I asked my wife, I was like, have you heard about this? She was like, no. And I was like, okay. And like a month later, all of her company's talking about it. It's on like South Park now, like making jokes about it. It's being talked at like the White House now. And I grew up in the 90s, right? And I still remember my dad having a rotary phone before they really stopped, you know, like that was a thing. And in high school, I remember seeing my first iPhone and someone was like, now it like does everything for me. I can't leave the house without it. I'm like, why? Like what? And it's like, I was printing out like directions on like MapQuest, how to get places.
My dad still does that.
You know, it's like, so there were these like moments in history for technology where it's like, oh, that's when that happened.
Yeah, and before I think and after
that's what
moment.
We're seeing now. Like this, like early 2023 is when AI happened in like the most real way possible so far. So I think this is a really major new chapter of technology, and it will behoove publishers to prepare for that, people to prepare for that, because this is here to stay and we don't quite understand it yet.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. You know, you think about the early internet, how impressed we all were that you could send like a picture of flowers to somebody else. It's like, look, I clicked it right here and they clicked send and receive. And
they received it.
A minute 30 later, it's right there in their inbox.
It couldn't be on the phone though. That had to be like off the phone for it to work, but it worked.
I think we'll be surprised at how impressed we are with things that we have now in just a few years. And that speaks to your point about like this being a before and after moment. I think we'll all sort of remember, you know, like this time in which it's like, before AI, after AI.
Where were you when ChatGPT was launched?
Yeah, when it enslaved us all. I remember back whenever we actually didn't have to like work for the machines.
I remember that. That was great. Well, thanks for joining us today. We're going to wrap up here. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about ChatGPT and AI and YouTube Shorts in the coming weeks. You can always tune in every week on YouTube and wherever your podcasts are to watch more of the Publisher Lab.